Believe me, Dan and I are privileged to have with us a very, very special attorney, Daniel Clow. You've probably read the story. He and Jennifer and their daughter, a story that really grabs you. I still got the copy. It was in the inside section of the Current. And this hour, this entire interview that we have, we've got the attorney with us, brought to you by Touchpoints Rehab Interview Chair, and the attorney is in the chair. Daniel, just as fabulous to have the attorney Clow with us this morning.
Good morning, Dan.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Brad. Thanks so much for having me on.
Just as an overview, by the way, Dan will take phone calls at 888-574-2723, but just give us an overview of the story involving your daughter and your family, Dan.
So this is a story of how my wife and I, Jennifer, and our daughter Mary and my two sons, have struggled with my daughter's mental health, challenges and her addiction, a very serious heroin addiction, crack, coke, wow. You name it. And it eventually intersected with the criminal justice system in the state of New York in August of 2015, leading to her arrest, finding herself in Rikers, and then my phone ringing, basically a voice saying, Daddy, can you come and get me? So as you can imagine, a very difficult thing for any family to go through. But the reason we wrote the story, which I'll describe in more detail as you like, is that our story is not unique. There are so many families out there of all backgrounds, all colors, all socioeconomic strata, who are dealing with children, adolescents, young adults who have a substance abuse problem, often combined with a mental health challenge. And it's a struggle for the family, and it's an even greater struggle if the kids get in trouble with the law.
You know, Attorney Clow.
Dan, please.
Okay, Dan. Everywhere that we go, and I'm out a lot, Dan's out a lot, we hear this story. It's like an epidemic. It truly, truly is.
Well, it is. And in recent years, the opioid addiction problem has become truly epidemic. I'm by no means an expert on it, but the price of heroin has come down tremendously. And something, a drug that when I was growing up, we thought of as something that was limited to, you know, really either just poor people or sick people, is now totally in the suburbs. It's available to anybody, and kids get hooked on it.
But how did Mary get hooked on drugs?
Well, Mary's story went this way. When she was in high school, her senior year, she was diagnosed with some significant neurological and mental health challenges. I don't want to go into the specific, you know, diagnoses, just to protect her privacy, which we've put out there quite a bit already. And by the way, this article and me being here, this is all done with Mary's full knowledge and consent. Right. So as a father, I would never have written a story like this and gone public.
Or been with us.
Right. Or been with you without discussing with my daughter, my wife, and lots of other people. But she was diagnosed with these challenges, and she wasn't ready to go to college. We found a program for her, sort of a gap year program up in Worcester, that combined independent living with internships, and we thought that it might, you know, help her. It would be a good stepping stone. When she finished that program, she refused to come home. She didn't want to come home. She wanted to be on her own. Now, take it. She's still only 18 or so. And she says, I don't want to come home. I'm going to go to Boston and try and find an apartment and a job there. And, you know, she was of age.
She didn't want to go to college then.
She was not ready to go to college still. And she wanted to break out on her own. I thought it was nuts. You know, she was too young. She wasn't equipped to do this, but she was 18. You know, you could not, we could not restrain her. You couldn't get her committed. So, There was really nothing we could do except hope and pray. So she goes up to Boston, and she tries to find an apartment. She gets one. It's rather sketchy. She finds a job. It's not working out very well. And that's where she begins, so we've learned, to experiment with some rather serious narcotics and drugs. And from there, it's just a long, slow descent into a form of hell for all of us. After she leaves Boston and she comes home, we manage to get her into an outpatient program at the Institute of Living in Connecticut to try and help her with her addiction. That helps a little bit. But her mental health challenges have a significant effect on her judgment. She takes risks that most people would realize are inappropriate. And she wakes up one day and says, I don't want to stay home anymore. I'm going to go hitchhike across the country.
Wow. Hitchhike.
Hitchhike alone across the country. So she may be 19 now, and she just goes to a bus stop. And again, we could not restrain her. And this is not a unique problem. You have a kid who's an adult. You can't get an involuntary restraining order. You can't get them locked up. So she begins to hitchhike across the country.
Wow.
And for basically a year and a half, my wife and I don't sleep very well.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Because every call, every time the phone rings, you're wondering, is this a police officer calling to say, I'm terribly sorry, but, you know, we found your daughter and she's dead.
When she got out of the institute and was back home, before she went on her hitchhiking sojourn, was she doing drugs when she was at home, do you think?
Well, we monitored the situation to the best of our ability, but I suspect that despite our best efforts, there were times when she was still using.
Easy to get, of course.
She knew the places in Hartford.
Of course.
She knew where to go. One thing, addicts are very knowledgeable about where to get a fix.
Right.
So, as I said, she was hitchhiking across the country. At one point, we got a phone call from her. She was in Oregon in a hospital in the emergency room and a total mess. We bought an airplane ticket and managed to get her back home, tried to get her cleaned up again, and she took off again. And this time was hitchhiking all the way down around the country, ended up living in Florida for a while. And eventually, this was what brought us to the story that I wrote. She was living in New York on the streets. I mean, she was an intentional. She was a homeless person. By choice. I mean, here are her parents saying, Miriam, come home, come home. Let us help you. No, Daddy. No, Mom. I don't want to come home. I like doing this. And this was a product of her mental illness plus her plus the addiction. And she found herself in a park on the Lower East Side of Manhattan one morning when an undercover police officer approached her. She was obviously in distress. She was an addict. She was sick. And he pressed her to make a buy. He said, I'm an addict, too. I'm trying to get a fix. You seem to know people around here. Can you help me find something? And as it's reported to us, and this is consistent with what the police reports say, she initially said, no, I don't want to do. And the undercover officer continued to press her. And Miriam has a tendency, because of the mental health diagnosis, to acquiesce when authority sort of presses her. And she went out and she found somebody to buy from, brought it back to the undercover officer, and bam.
Can you imagine?
I can't. Arrested her.
Unbelievable.
Okay, hold that thought. I think we have traffic coming
up. Yeah, we've got traffic. Just hold it.
Yeah.
Dan, it's just to have you with us with this story. This is an incredible
weather, traffic, politics with Brad and Dan. This is the Brad and Dan Show on the Talk of Connecticut.
20 minutes after 7 o'clock and a very, very special guest, attorney Daniel Clow. He and his wife Jennifer and daughter, and the daughter in big, big trouble several times. And We just wanted to have him on our program, and it's very dramatic, Dan. I mean, you can't, you know, it's hard to understand what a couple has to go through.
Well, and the entire family, your two sons. But so Mary gets caught again, this time in New York City, and then what happens, Dan?
Well, so as I said, so she's arrested, and this is how my wife and I found out about this. My phone rings at work, and I get an automated call, and it's a tape recording saying an incarcerated person wants to reach you. If you want to talk to them, give us our credit card, you know, call this number, give us our credit card number, and you'll be able to talk to this person. And I sort of, you know, laughed at myself. This is a scam. Then my cell phone rang, and I got the same recorded message. You know, a person who's incarcerated at Rikers wants to talk to you. Please call this number. Give us your credit card. And then I picked up my phone, and I called my wife, and I said, are you getting this automated phone call? And she says, yes. And we both instantly knew that it was our daughter, that she had been arrested and that she was trying to reach us. Now, this is where the story gets kind of surreal, okay? You can't talk to the prisoner. You cannot talk to a person at Rikers until you arrange through this intermediary telephone service to give them your credit card number and because the call...
How do you know the service is legit, by the
way? Well, that's what I was going to ask, too.
Right. Well, when it came into three calls, you know, when the call came to my number, my work number, my cell, and my wife, it was clear that this was clearly Miriam trying to reach us, right? So we contacted did a quick search on the web to make sure that this was, in fact, the way phone calls originate from Rikers. And so we no longer were concerned that it was a scam. We reached out and we provided the information, financial information, so that we could accept the calls. And that whole process took 24 hours.
Wow. 24 hours?
24 hours to get that. And then Miriam did not have access to the telephone all the time, so she would call and I wouldn't be there or something. So it took 24 hours before we were able to connect. And as I recall, I'm trying to think, I think it might have been a weekend. And we eventually learned that that she had to post... She had to post bail. It wasn't too atrocious. It was $1,500. So I went to the bank. I got $1,500 in cash, and I drove down to Rikers to bail my daughter out.
Can you imagine?
I can't.
My God, my God.
So then what happens?
So we picked her up. We had a court date. You know, she had been arraigned already, but we had a court date. And now I'm an attorney, but I'm a civil law attorney, so I don't do criminal work. But I have many friends, colleagues who are criminal specialists. And I made a lot of phone calls to a lot of people, including lawyers in New York. And because the question was, you know, do we hire a private attorney? Are there good defenses to the charges? How should you deal with this? And every single person said the same thing. They said, Daniel, New York Drug Treatment Court has a diversionary program for first-time offenders with a substance abuse problem. The diversionary program is a treatment program. And the concept, and this is a very good concept, right? So I want to give kudos to New York for having this program available. The idea is the state doesn't want to stick first-time offenders with a substance abuse problem in jail. They know that just throwing them in jail for, this was an old Rockefeller law that she was, you know, charged with violating, that doesn't work. So the idea is to get them into treatment. It took 4 months, however, 4 months from August almost up until December, late August up to December, to get her evaluated by the court system to determine whether she was an appropriate candidate for the drug treatment diversionary
program. Wow, she's suffering all along this time.
She still, get this, she still wouldn't come home. We couldn't force her to come home.
Wow.
She was still living on the streets, but here's the amazing thing. She had weekly court appearances. While this evaluation process is waiting to take place, the court was requiring her to show up every week and check in. And she wanted, she didn't want to go to jail, so somehow she managed to get herself to court every week. And I would meet her there, or my wife would meet her there. So she was doing that, even though she was still sick, addicted, on the streets. Eventually, she had this evaluation. She fully disclosed her mental health issues, the challenges. And she was determined to be an appropriate candidate for a treatment program. So in December of 2015, she was began treatment at a program in Brooklyn. And we thought that would be terrific. Now, here's the thing about treatment programs. In order to enter the diversionary program, assuming that you're accepted, you have to plead guilty. That's the ticket. That's the price of admission. And this is not just New York. So here's the way it works. The court says to the person, we think you'd be a good candidate for a diversionary, you know, drug treatment program. If you complete the program, and it's usually something in the nature of 12 to 15 months, okay, your charges will be dismissed. But here's the kicker. In order to create a real incentive for you to be diligent and work hard at the treatment program, you have to plead guilty. We will hold the guilty plea in our back pocket, basically.
Well, what, you're an attorney. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, all I can say, I have a lot of thoughts on that. I understand why the court system thinks that it needs the leverage. That's the idea. The idea is that the guilty plea is the leverage to really encourage the person to work seriously in the treatment program.
So they'll do it.
So they'll do it. It's like a carrot and stick approach. That's the psychology behind it. From a legal perspective, I think it's rather coercive to force a person to plea. And here's the thing. If you don't successfully complete the guilty the treatment program, you're stuck with the guilty plea.
Wow.
You know? But again, as I said, this is not just New York. Connecticut has a similar diversionary program. Other states around the country do it. And as coercive as I find the system, it hasn't been held unconstitutional.
Daniel, you and Jennifer, how long so far have you been living with this? How long?
Well, it's probably coming up on over 3 years, almost 4 years now. Not the criminal aspect. The criminal situation in New York is a year and a half. But the problems of dealing with a child with addiction and mental health issues go back quite a few years before that.
And has progress been made?
Yes, absolutely. This is the strange thing, right? So my article was almost a primal scream, you know, on my behalf about the struggles that she was having in the New York system, which I thought was not sufficiently sensitive to her mental health challenges. But here's the strange thing. I firmly believe that if my daughter had not been arrested in August of 2015, in all likelihood, she would be dead. She would be dead of an overdose. My wife and I would have received, you know, that horrible call. She was so sick. So the arrest, in a bizarre way, was a godsend because it, although it took a while, as I described, to get her into the program, once she was in the program, she was off the streets. She was in a safe location. She was able to get off the drugs for a long period of time. There was a relapse, which I'll discuss in a little bit, but she was basically able to get clean, and then the struggle began to find appropriate mental health care.
Our special guest this morning, Attorney Daniel Clow, you've heard his story. He and his wife, Jennifer, went through this, and the reason that Dan and I wanted Daniel to come on here and to tell the story was there are others out there that are suffering exactly the same thing. And we're going to return to our discussion right after the news. Stay with us, please. This is a story that had to be told, and to have the attorney with us this morning is just incredible.
Attorney Dan Clow with us, talking about his daughter Mary and the family. So, Dan, where does the case stand now?
So the case, remarkably, when I wrote the article, it was after we had appeared in court at the beginning of January. And it was a regular check-in with a new judge, however. The judge who had presided over the case for more than a year and who had been wonderful had retired. And we had a new judge. And Miriam had struggled with the treatment programs, as I describe. These programs were designed for people with substance abuse addictions, but really were not designed to also deal with people who had significant mental health challenges. So although she was making significant progress on the treating her addiction, the her difficulty in conforming to the rules of the program led to her being discharged. And one first program literally put her out on the street one afternoon. After 6 months, they just said, Miriam, we're discharging you, and they put her out on the street. And she relapsed.
Right to the street?
Just left, put her out.
Wow. Wow.
I can't even begin to describe to this day how angry I am at the program for doing it that way. If they felt they needed to discharge her, fine, do it in the morning, arrange it so that we have notice, we can pick her up. You know, and she had a report to court. So, but she relapsed. She was scared to death. She didn't want to tell us that she had been discharged. Mm-hmm. And, she was accepted by another program, but that program, too, after a month, decided we are not equipped to deal with her mental health challenges. So they threw in Rikers. And for 2 months over the summer, roughly 2 months, I would go down on weekends and visit my daughter at Rikers Island. Rikers Island.
Wow.
And
that's the prison.
That's the prison.
That's
wow.
It.
That's the prison. Now, the Rikers Island prison that we see on television generally focuses on the men's, unit. For young female nonviolent offenders, there's a separate building, if you will. It's still Rikers, but it's not like the horrific stuff you see. But it's scary. And watching your daughter let off from court in handcuffs and visiting her in prison in a, you know, in a jumpsuit, it is nothing. No family should ever have to go through this. You asked, where are things now? So we've been struggling to persuade the court, since we couldn't find a program in New York, to let her do a program in Connecticut, because we had access to a, you know, a program was prepared to accept her, and one that was more suitable to her mental health challenges. And as I said in the article, last month the judge was dead set against that. Absolutely, just no, she has to be in a New York program. So Tuesday of this week, we went back to court. It was a regularly scheduled court date. Miriam and I drove into the city, both scared to death about the outcome. I really thought that she was going to be thrown in prison because we hadn't found a New York program.
Right.
And then a stunning development. The diversionary treatment program, every court appearance provides a little brief written status report to the court. And in this one, at the end of the report, was a recommendation that blew my mind. All of a sudden, they said, in light of Miriam's significant health, mental health issues and our inability to find an appropriate treatment program in New York, we recommend that she stay with her parents and do a treatment program in Connecticut.
Which is what you wanted.
Which is what we wanted. And I was beyond stunned at this. Now, the thing is, this is just a recommendation from the treatment program. You still have to convince the district attorney, who I described in the article as absolutely unsympathetic to Miriam's mental health issues, and you have to convince the judge to accept the recommendation. So our attorney was able to take this positive report also take a report that we had hired an expert, a forensic psychiatrist in Connecticut, a psychiatrist whose job is to basically evaluate people who are in the court system and prepare reports for the court. So we had her evaluated, and we prepared a report, and we submitted it. And we were able to get the district attorney and the judge to accept that recommendation. So the status right now is that Miriam is home with us. She's sure in bed right now at home. We are working very hard to get her accepted into a program in Connecticut. There are a few that we're looking at. I think we'll be successful. The requirement from the court's perspective will be that she complete a minimum 12-month program. And if she successfully completes that program, and I pray, no guarantees, but I pray that she will, the charges against her and her guilty plea will be dropped. Okay?
How does she react now to you and Jennifer? What is her reaction to the both of you?
Well, I can tell you that when we left the court on Tuesday, just Mary and I, my wife and I trade off court appearances. You know, we're down there frequently, and there's no need for both of us to go there. But this burden was lifted, this emotional weight. Miriam had been lying in bed for a week before the court date this week because, she was very, nervous that in all likelihood she was going to be tossed back in jail and be stuck for life with a felony record. And now I think that in light of this recommendation that I just described, there's this tremendous sense of relief. And I could see it in her face, and I could see it in just her body. And there was a certain lightness. Now, let me be clear. Miriam, mental health issues will not be just disappear in a year. This is a long road for anybody who has the kind of mental health challenges that Miriam faces. Right?
What are some of the challenges like?
Well, I mean, she has, as I said, her particular challenges. She doesn't have a severe illness like schizophrenia or paranoia or delusions. She has a disorder which affects her, has a physical impact on her prefrontal cortex and affects her judgment.
She's been diagnosed.
This is not just Ad making it up. She has been diagnosed by multiple physicians who all agree that she has several. I mean, it's just a terrible thing for anybody to have one, but when you throw in three specific diagnoses, different challenges, and she's on a variety of medications to help deal with them, not opioids, medications to help her deal with, for example, bipolar and some borderline personality disorder issues. So she has a long treatment path, even beyond the 1-year commitment to the court. But as I said, on the addiction front, she's made tremendous progress. She's absolutely dedicated to staying clean. She is very involved in NA, which is the narcotics version of Alcoholics Anonymous, goes to meetings. She's required to check in per the court and have a weekly drug test.
Wow.
Weekly drug test, and those have been coming up clean for the past 6 months. So I would say, relative to my state of mind when I wrote this article, things have changed for the better. But there, she struggled with the treatment programs in the past, and there's no guarantee. There are no guarantees that this new program we hope to get her into will be perfect. But we think it's much more promising because it's focused on her mental health issues as opposed to just substance abuse.
You know, as I sit here and listen to you, and I'm sure Dan feels the same way, you can't help but wonder how many others are out there like you.
Well, you write about that, and you also say many others don't have the legal standing that you do. I mean, you're an attorney, you know people, others are going through this, and look at all that you and your family have gone through.
We are not alone, and that's really the point of the story. I mean, people will tell you that the best way or a very effective way to convey a general point is through a story that talks about specific people. And that was what brought my wife and me and Mary to decide to publish our story. I mean, it really is a bearing of the soul, and you have to wonder what would drive a person to share with the world this.
Dan, what's the reaction been since the article was published in The Current?
It has been astonishing, Dan. Absolutely astonishing. I mean, obviously, when we published something in the paper, we knew that friends, folks who knew us would reach out. But what I did not expect was the overwhelming support from total strangers, total complete strangers from around the state who have been writing me. They take the time to go on the internet, find my address, find my email, call me at work, call me at home. My wife gets the same things. On Facebook, somebody, a friend of the family, posted a link to the Hartford Current story on Facebook, and hundreds and hundreds of people were responding to this. And they all say the same thing. First, they say, Daniel, and you and your wife are so brave for telling this story. I have a difficult time thinking of myself as a brave person. The brave person in here is Mary, who's been dealing with this for so long. But the next thing they say is, thank you for writing this. We have been struggling the same way or the similar way, and to know that there's other people out there who are sharing the struggle gives us strength to deal with it. So somehow people who are in, and there are hundreds and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people across the country who have the same experience that my family did.
They, you know, when you sit here, Dan, like we are today talking with the attorney, it's hard to believe that this is an epidemic, but it is.
It is.
An epidemic across America. 7:51, 9 minutes before 8 o'clock, and a very special broadcast this morning. Attorney Daniel Clow, how he and his wife and beautiful daughter have gone through and are still going through something that so many Americans are going through. And you know, Dan, that is the hard thing to understand. Here we are sitting in our broadcast studio, and it just comes to you how many more, and to have somebody like Daniel who has the guts to be able to sit and to tell us because he wants to help other people.
Well, that's the key. You know, why would somebody write, I mean, go so public as to write an article and disclose the struggles of their family? Why would you do it? And I have to admit, I mean, the way the article began was I came back from this hearing in early January, where the judge was adamant that he was going to throw Miriam in jail unless we could find a program in New York. And I was so angry and so frustrated. I often write as
You do. You've got a blog. Tell your audience about
that. I have a blog. I mean, I'm a lawyer, and I write about legal issues.
We want the blog so the folks that are listening here.
Although the blog, it's called appealinglybrief.com. But it's a blog about the law. But I write because I like to write, and I also find it therapeutic. So this article actually began with me just sitting down at my computer angry, so angry, and using the writing process to try and help calm down emotionally. And after I did it, I shared it with my wife, and I shared it with Mary, and we raised the idea of turning it into something publishable. Is there a way that we can do something constructive by sharing our experience? And my wife she remembered an obituary sometime within the past year. It was about a teenager who had died of a drug overdose, I think heroin, and she remembered that in the obituary the parents made a specific decision to say that the child died of a drug overdose. And the reason was we should not keep this kind of problem secret. It shouldn't be a secret anymore. We have to go public. People need to understand that this is not some isolated phenomenon anymore. Anybody of any background can be struck with this kind of struggle. And by sharing, everybody who's going through this struggle, I think, can draw strength from it. And we support each other. I've gotten hundreds of phone calls from people telling me, Daniel, here's a treatment facility you should check out. Here's another treatment facility. Have you thought of this? Here's a support group for families that you might be interested in that can help folks like you who are going through this. And the only way you learn about these things is by being willing to share the experience publicly. Now, I'm not saying that everybody should write the equivalent of a full-page op-ed in a newspaper, but they should know that they're not alone, that there are other families sharing their struggles, and that there are families out there who want to help them by directing them to the appropriate support groups. And hopefully we can get the criminal justice system to address the particular problem that we've been facing.
That was going to be my next question.
Yes.
Where do we go from here to try and turn this into something that's not treated as a criminal case, but as one where someone has some mental illness?
That's what's got to happen.
That is actually what has to happen. And as I said, early on, I commend New York and all the states that are working to keep first-time drug offenders out of prison and getting them treatment. That is absolutely the right way to go. The actual process of how it's done needs some work, and that was some of the frustration in my article. But what I hope the article does is generate a greater awareness of the need for mental health treatment in addition to substance abuse treatment, because so many people, like my daughter, they're not just addicts. They're addicts with a significant mental health issue, and you need the treatment for both of those. And by the way, I am not suggesting for one minute that the state and the taxpayers should necessarily be on the tab for this. My wife and I, we have insurance. We wanted to put our daughter in a program at our expense that would satisfy the needs of the justice system. So those options should be available for everybody.
Now, you say you do have a website.
Yes.
I'm thinking about the audience that we have, and we read the story. I'll never forget the story. In fact, I've got it right here, and it was on my desk and has been. And Dan and I talked about it, and then decided we didn't know whether or not you would be yes and come on here and tell what you have told this past hour. But the reason that I would like to have you give your website, because I know there are people who are listening to us that will do the same thing as the folks that saw the story and what you have done. I just think it's marvelous that you had, the courage to do this. You and Jennifer, I haven't met many folks like this. So, again, what is the website where they could get a hold of you if they want to help, and I'm sure many do?
Well, my website is appealinglybrief.com. So that's one word, appealinglybrief.com. www.appealinglybrief. As I said, it's the website where I mostly talk about legal issues, national and local state issues, but it has all of my contact information. So if people are looking to contact me, they can go right to that address and it will have contact information. www.appealinglybrief.com.
Well, I'll tell you, Daniel, this has been an eye-opener for both Dan and myself, and this is what we're here for. I never, when I saw the story and when Dan saw it, we started to talk about you and your family, and then decided to go and see if we could get you to join us here in the morning for our radio audience, and you were kind enough to say yes. So again, thank you. Thank Jennifer and Marie for being so cooperative, and we certainly We'll keep in touch. God bless you.
Thank you so much for having me on, Brad. I really appreciate it.